close enough.
Well, I don't know. Let's try it and see.
I was gonna say, if you want it on something more.
No, I think this will be fine.
Okay, Mrs. Kennedy, tell me a little bit about your family background and where you grew up.
Well, I was born and raised in Alliance, Ohio, at 908 Parkway Boulevard, and lived there all my life. My family lived there after all the children were grown, and my mother died 5 years ago, and then we sold the family home. And they built the home they started the home 2 days before World War I was declared, and they ran into problems getting materials and building their home because of that war. So that was my home, and I have two brothers and two sisters. There were five children in the family. My father was in the wallpaper and paint business, and it always meant that all the children had a job. No more than sweeping up or trimming wallpaper, because at that time wallpaper had to be trimmed on machine or hand trimmed. Mm-hmm. So we were kept very busy. And I don't know what else to tell you about my family, except both of my parents lived to be the ripe old age of 89, so I'm sure that hard work didn't affect their.
You graduated from high school when?
I graduated high school in January of 1939, and August 12th of this year I'll be going to my 50th class reunion. And I graduated in January because at that time we did have mid-year classes.
Were you made aware in school of Hitler's movements in Europe? Were you aware that he was invading Poland and that war might be coming
Yes.
very quickly?
We were made aware of the fact that there was this problem in Europe, and there was this man, Hitler. I had a girl in my class all through school by the name of Frieda Reinhardt, and her folks were from Germany, and when she went over to Germany to see her grandparents, she came back and told us about this wonderful man that would really turn Europe around by the name of Adolf Hitler. I can see her standing up in front of our class when I was in about the eighth grade. And she said that people were back to work. They were no longer carrying their money in bushel baskets. You know, their money was worthless then. And that was a result of World War I. And they never had recovered from that till this great man, Hitler, had come along, and he was the savior of Germany. And so we had that in our mind. And of course, during those years, when I was in elementary and the first years in high school, there was great peace movements among the young people. And when we would go to camp, we would learn songs like, I don't want to march in the infantry, I don't want to ride in the cavalry, I don't want to shoot the artillery, I want to be friendly. And things like that. So if I could sing, I'd sing it to you. But we were all being indoctrinated into the peace thinking. It was the time they were trying to create the World Court and the League of Nations, and everything was going to be wonderful. Peace was what we were taught a great deal. The day I arrived at Miami University in September of 1939, we got a newspaper that night at school, and it was the day that Germany invaded Poland. So just as soon as I got to school, began the war years,
right.
Really. Although we weren't in it then for quite a while, but we started to become very conscious of this, and it wasn't until months after that we even knew there was any thing like the Holocaust. I mean, that went on for a long time before it was, if our government leaders knew it, they certainly did not make it public to the people. And so I think my college years were really my war years. pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
And
how did college change? What changes did you notice in college after December the 7th, 1941?
Well, the first thing was the change in the enrollment. When I entered Miami in that year, there were between 650 and 700 full-time freshman students. And when we graduated 4 years later, and of that number, three-fourths were boys and one-fourth were female students. That's one reason I selected the school. But in 4 years, it had turned completely around. We had around 300 graduate, not because they failed school, but they did not defer the boys in school at that time. And they were, every week we could see them, our classes becoming smaller and smaller. And when we graduated, the class was three-fourths women and one-fourth men. And if you were a man and you were still in school, there was a little bit of a stigma attached to it.
Hmm.
You know, what's wrong with him?
It certainly cut into the social life and the activities too, didn't it?
Yes, it certainly did, because most all the big events were canceled. We did continue to have football games and things like that, but it wasn't the quality of programming that we'd normally have. And of course, Miami was one of the few schools, and I think it still does as far as freshmen are concerned, that has 100% dorm system. You have to actually be a resident of the town or live in a dormitory. Now, they don't have that policy now. But even all the classes were in the dorm, lived in the dormitory system. So in the evenings, it was pretty gloomy. There was none of this dating going on. And of course, the first year was great. This all, more or less, we began to feel it the second year. But in the evenings, we couldn't study all the time. So the girls would be grouped together on war projects. They would bring in boxes, crates almost, of olive drab yarn. And we all had a teacher to teach us how to make leg warmers, helmet liners, scarves, and sweaters. And I never graduated to the sweater class, but I did make the other, I learned to make the other three. And also, there was a great deal of, they didn't have the machinery to roll bandages like they do now. And since the companies that made bandages were supplying the war effort, and that meant that the local hospitals were greatly in need of things like that. So then they would bring material and we would tear it and cut it and roll bandages at night. Also, another thing that was required was that we were all asked to take a non-credit war course, something that we could do in the war effort. Rich, you might like to know, as soon as we started, Mr. Rudabaugh started to make Modi. That's why we moved
every
inside.
Every time we had something outside, somebody mowing the lawn.
Well, she had just said to me, we'll be all right out here in the porch as long as nobody starts to mow the grass next door, and exactly what happened. We're ready to turn the recorder on. So we moved in here.
Well, anyway, we had to select. This was our second year. We had to select a war course. And you tried to get something that was given that would fit into your schedule. And the one that I was in was Morse code combined with typing. So we would have the earphones on after we learned the code alphabet. And we would hear the code, and then we'd have to type as we'd listen to the Morse code. And foreign language was never my strong point anyway. And I don't know which was worse, the code or the typing, but I never I knew I wasn't going to be graded in it, but that's what I took, and it has that little bit of typing was the only typing I ever had, and it turned out to be one of the most valuable things in my life.
What were some of the other things that you could have selected other than that?
Well, they had a lot in first aid, in driving large vehicles, you know,
I can see
trucks,
you now out in the truck,
and things of that nature, hospital, you know, working in hospital, record keeping, a lot of learning to be a draftsman, and can't think of all the things, but there was, everybody had to take one non-credit course that prepared them if they were needed in service. Mm-hmm. So that was how we spent our time.
See, that's something I've never heard of before. That's really interesting. Mm-hmm. Now, that was at Miami, down in Oxford.
Mm-hmm.
Were all the state schools doing that?
No, not all of them were geared to that. One of the things that happened in Miami was in 41, the Navy, most all of them had programs for college boys, reserve programs that they could sign up for, either for the Army or the Navy. And the Navy was called V-5 and V-7. What was the Army called?
What?
The Army Reserve Program you signed up for.
ASPP.
Well, anyway, the Navy came to Miami. There's no water around Miami, but that's where they
the
school they selected for some of their programs. Now, here are the programs that they had. I said here many colleges were used for training centers. Miami was assigned by the U.S. Navy several programs. One was civilian pilot training program. And they also, the Navy put in their radio training school there. Then, in 1942, they made it a center for training waves. Now, do you know what waves are? They were the women in the Navy. And they were trained there in their drill and their basic training. And then the ones that were kept there were given a mostly secretarial so they could go into office work with the Navy. And also we had a group called the Weeds, W-E-E-D-S, and they were women in the engineering corps of the Navy that were taught drafting. So then from the previous non-credit drafting course, it became a school for the Navy to teach drafting.
Hmm.
And most of the people in that were women, which was unusual.
And then where would they go with that? To aircraft plants?
Well,
and things
after
like
they
that?
Would finish their basic there, they would pull them out and assign them all over the world. Many of them went overseas.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Or went on to Navy bases in different countries or in this country. And they did most of the office work, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of postal work
mm-hmm.
involved and things like that. And we always envied the waves. They look so chic in their outfits and everything. And a great number of girls from Miami and several from my class, one I still correspond with, graduated and stayed at Miami in the course and took her training in the waves and was commissioned officer from Miami, as well as a graduate of Miami. So it became very popular for the women to do that.
What were you majoring in?
All right. I went to school. My dad said there were so many of us children, we had to know what we were going to do when we started. We couldn't fool around and say, well, I'm going to feel my way.
Mm-hmm.
And
not going to have time to find yourself, huh?
And one reason I selected Miami was it was well known in health and physical education. And that I had a very fine phys ed teacher in Alliance. Her name was Lucille Pettit, and she encouraged me to go into something like that. Well, so I went into the School of Education, secondary education, and I was to major in health and physical education, which I started in and which I finished in, but along the way, since there weren't no men on campus and you had a lot of time to study, I had I did well in sciences. So I ended up with a major in biological sciences and a major in health and physical education and a minor in history and social studies. So, and I did practice teaching in all three of them. So you
no,
see, we
no
had
no wonder
all
you subbed so much in Lisbon, because they could put you anywhere.
So those are my three fields. But then that's what I took in school. But anyway, in the summertime, we'd come home. Kids didn't go to school in the summer then.
Right.
I mean, we were on the semester system. And when June came, everybody, and I mean everybody, faculty took off. And it wasn't till the end of the war years, and when the boys were coming back and they were trying to catch up
mm-hmm.
in a hurry, they started the quarter system and they would go year round.
What did you do in the summer then? Go home and work at the store?
I would go home. Well, my first summer, the war wasn't really, the United States wasn't in the war.
Right.
So because of what my major was, the college got me a job at a camp up on Lake Michigan. And I worked at camp that first summer because that was one of our requirements to have a camp training experience. So I got that over with early. And I was glad because the next year I went home, I got a job at the Tailcraft Airplane Factory in Alliance.
Doing what?
And the Tailcraft Factory built tandem trainers, training small airplanes to train pilots. It was the basic training for to become a pilot. And my job was a newly created job. And I was the blueprint girl. And there was only one in the factory. And the factory was here, the office building was here. And they built corridor between, glassed-in corridor. And in the middle of that corridor, they built a cage. And I was the girl in the cage, not the go-go girl, but the girl in the cage. Because during the war, every blueprint for an Army order had to be under lock and key, or had to be secure. Everything was secret then. Everything had to be secret. Now, I don't know why anybody would want any of those blueprints or could make a part, but apparently...
Well, I think we were paranoid, don't you?
Yes, and it was government regulation, and if you had an Army contract, this was one of the requirements. So I had every blueprint in that cage for every part that was to be made that went into a Tailcraft. In those days, they didn't sublet contracts. Everything for the plane was made there except the motor or the engine. And they did bring those in. And so I would have to be there an hour earlier than anybody else because the foreman would come in early. They would have their work order. They'd show me the work order. I had to know each part that went in the airplane by number and could go, and I'd sign out like a librarian each print to the foreman, and he would sign for it. Then he would know what his department was going to cut or make that day, what part of the plane. Well, many of these foremen would get four or five prints. And so they would do their studying during their lunch hour, and they would put them in their lunch box. You know, they'd go out and sit around the yard.
Yeah.
And when they'd come in and make the print, the print would stay in the lunch box. They would go home at night, and I couldn't leave till every print was back in the cage. And then I had to look up where they live, get them on the phone, stay there until they would bring the print back, because I couldn't go home at night till they were all back. So I learned later, I started out before the end of the time.
As soon as lunch was over, you started getting the
print. Yeah, I started calling them in. But I know that about the first month I was there, I'd be there maybe till midnight trying to get those prints back, because they lived in Canton and other places, and they knew their job was gone if they didn't bring it back.
Now, this Tailcraft plant was in Alliance?
Yes, in the north end of town. And it was there a good many years after the war, too. So that was my job the first year. And the second year I came back, they had a full-time girl in there. So they put me in the production control department, which was under engineering. And since I knew the all the blueprints and the parts by numbers. They hadn't even changed the plane in that time. I was there, and then when the prints would come down from drafting, I would figure the amount of material needed for each part for each day and get the work orders ready, send them to the foreman, then they would take it to the supply room and it had down how many square feet of what material. And my worst mistake was there was a tiny little part that was to be done that I figured, supposedly, I was to figure it in square inches and I figured it in square feet. And when they went to get the material, there wasn't enough material in the whole factory to do it. And it stopped the whole production line for one day till we figured out where the mistake came from.
And then you're like a real dummy.
So that was that. Then I worked there the summer of 41, 42, and after I graduated the first summer, after I was out, because I hadn't started to teach yet, but there was a great demand for teachers because a lot of the men teachers had been taken, especially in the secondary school where more men taught. So you had your pick of schools, and I narrowed mine down to two places. Well, three: Bellevue, Ohio; Girard, Ohio; and Canton Timken, which is just being built. And if I'd have gone to Bellevue, I would have started teaching biology. Canton Girard needed a health and physical education teacher. So I took Girard over the new school, which was a big temptation because I would get $100 a year more. My salary was $1,200 a year, $100 a month. We were paid on a 12-month basis. But I would have only got 11 at Canton and 12 at Girard. And then during those years, from 43 to 46, the real war years, you couldn't have an apartment, so the teachers roomed with the family. You had a room with a family. And I was very fortunate. I roomed on 800 Broadway, North Broadway, which was just two blocks from the school, with a very nice elderly man and woman who had a son that was a coach and had been a coach in Niles, and they were very, you know, interested and very nice to live with. And we didn't have, we had kitchen privileges. And I think my rent was $12 a month. So even though you didn't make more, you still, you know, you could make ends meet. So I taught there then three years. There was one other thing. While I was teaching, there were the shortages.
That's what I wanted to ask.
That really affected not only us personally, but the school.
Yeah. How did that work in the school system? How did they survive?
Well, the shortage that affected the school the most was the shortage of coal. Everything was heated by coal. And being in the Steel Valley, the industry needed all the coal they could get. And many times there wouldn't be enough coal come into the area to supply the schools with coal to heat the schools. And we'd go as long as we could without heat, you know. And we all dressed for it. But it was kind of hard to put on the gym suits and all.
They were so lovely anyway.
Yeah, when it was freezing weather. But many times the schools would just have to be closed. Well, where could you go? You were a teacher living with a family. You had no way to get home. So there was four of us single teachers that lived pretty close, and we played bridge. In
you
one of
no
our rooms.
To go anywhere,
well,
you
we didn't have a car. I didn't have a car, and three of us didn't have a car, but our home ec teacher had a car. Now, each teacher, whether she had a car or not, was given a ration coupon for 2 gallons of gas a week. So the four of us would give our gas to the one teacher, and then she would provide us with transportation when we needed it. And on Saturday night, we'd go out to eat someplace. She would drive. There was a place called Club 422, and that wasn't far. So we would eat almost every Saturday night and then out there. And then she would take us to the...
Can you imagine?
I think we'll pick up more grass cutting than we are anything else.
She would take us someplace to eat, and then if we needed transportation to a train station, she could take us there. Then there was a Catholic priest at St. Rose School there, and he was unlimited on gas. So when things got too bad, he was very good to the school teachers. He would always say, now in emergency, you call me. And he saw that we got work. Now, another shortage was the housing shortage. I think I mentioned that. And I told you about how we solved that as teachers. But even after Rich and I were married, in fact, we wouldn't be in Lisbon today if it wasn't that when Rich came to interview for a job, Mr. Riddle said, well, if you will come here, there's an apartment above the office that you can have till you find something you like. And that was one of the big drawing things, was to find something. So the housing shortage went on after the good deal, after the war, because that was 50 when we came here, and there was still this housing shortage that had been caused by the war. You know, you stop building.
Sure, you have to.
It's going to bound, it's bound to pile up, mm-hmm. So that was the big problem. To go any distance was almost impossible. You couldn't get a flight anyplace unless you were in the Army or had some way of some connection. So if you wanted to go anyplace, transportation shortage. Now, Rich's father was a conductor on the Pennsylvania Central Railroad. And Rich and I had gone together in high school and through college, and one thing another. And Rich was stationed at Fort Riley, Kansas. And so that Christmas that he was out there, I think it was the Christmas of 43, his father called me one day in Girard and said that what they'd like to do for Rich for Christmas was send me out visiting. So he got me a ticket to go, even with a Pullman ticket, to go out to Manhattan, Kansas, to visit Rich for Christmas. And I remember he took me to the train, to get on the train, down at the train station Alliance, and I went out to North Lima. Then I had to wait about 6 hours to change trains to go to Chicago, and then I got on the Pullman in Chicago. But when I got there, the train was late and the Pullman had gone. And so I had to go by coach the rest of the way. They got me on a later train, but I never did get my
Pullman. You never saw your Pullman.
I never saw my Pullman, but I made it. And I remember I carried big shopping, canvas shopping bag full of his Christmas presents with me, with his folks, because to send anything in the mail was very difficult too. Although things got mailed, delivered to Army posts better than any place else. But little did I know that I was carrying my engagement ring with me.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. You didn't snoop?
No, I didn't know.
I'm disappointed.
Well, anyway, that
at
was
the end
that.
Of the war, at the end of the war,
yeah.
What happened to all of these women teachers?
All
did
right.
You find yourselves out of a job again? Maybe you weren't interested in a job at that point.
No, there was still a demand because the training had been cut down so much by people going into services.
Mm-hmm.
And also there was the increase in the baby boom came along as teachers. There has always been a demand in health and physical education. Even when there was a surplus in the late 70s, remember when there was teachers every place, there was still always openings in that field, more so than in any other. But I wanted to mention too what happened in the school when the May 7th.
Before you get to the end, where were you on December the 7th, 1941?
All right. December the 7th. You mean when
the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor.
Pearl Harbor. Well, I have that on here. 1941, December the 7th. Oh, that was something else. Being in health and physical education, I had a class in modern dance and dance.
Mm-hmm.
And the Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo, that's a Russian ballet, was giving their Christmas concert in Cincinnati, Ohio, which wasn't far from Miami. And I had an opportunity to go down for a Saturday night performance to, I can't remember the name, I think it was called the Palace Theater in Cincinnati, to see the ballet. And so I couldn't get back to school in time because we had dorm hours. So my mother had written permission that I could go and I could stay with a friend called Florence Peters, who was also going, and her home was in Hamilton, Ohio, which is nearby. And so the morning, Sunday morning, when we were coming down the stair steps, we slept in, and it was about, I think, between 10 and 11 o'clock. We were coming down the steps, and in those days, people only had one radio in the house.
Right.
And their steps were kind of in the center of the house, and at the foot of the steps was their radio, so people could hear it in the kitchen, whatever room. They had the radio on, and we were about halfway down the steps, and we heard that Pearl Harbor had been bombed. So that's where I was on December 7th.
What was your immediate reaction?
Well, we, of course, I don't know, we'd been living with the war, you know, in Europe, and of course we hadn't sent anybody over there yet, but we knew we were about ready to, regardless. So I guess we just thought this was another facet of the war at the time. We knew we were really in it then, though. And it's, but another, other dates
did
kind of.
No, you have one all to yourself.
The other dates that I remember were May 7th, 1943. That was DE Day, and school was still on. And at that time, they kept assuring, reminding the students that the war wasn't over yet, because so many of them were still, you know, the.
Did high school collect for war bonds?
Yes.
The kids, the way they
yes.
How'd that work?
Well, the children would buy stamps, and they had a stamp book, and maybe they'd even bring a quarter and buy one stamp and put it in their stamp book, and then after they'd fill their book, then they would, you know, they could get money for it with interest at any of the banks.
Now, did you have a home room? Did you dealt with those kids to put their money? You know, today
yeah.
If teachers touch money in the school system, heaven forbid,
yeah.
Everyone's hysterical because of all the legal ramifications and everything.
I liked the system they had in Girard. You had a home room that had so many freshmen, sophomore, junior, and senior. Each year you'd lose a few and you'd gain a few. They didn't have guidance counselors, but you had the same homeroom teacher. Teachers didn't move around as much for 4 years. When you would go in, say, you would have the same homeroom. And we had to visit each family during the year, and they would have us for Christmas dinners and things like that. And we handled all the money. If the kids got in trouble, we were the ones that the teacher had us call the parents because we knew them. Most of our parents were first generation immigrants in Girard, Finnish or Italian or Slavic, and many of them, the parents could not speak English, or if you couldn't make them understand. They could say basic things, which could. So you had to have take the child with you and have them translate.
And somehow in translation, I don't think the story probably got back exactly
but
it should have.
That was it. But
it is a neat system.
And it worked very well. Boy, you knew those kids. And when we got married, they all came to our wedding,
yeah.
My homeroom kids. But anyway, in May 7th, when we heard in school that there had been victory in Europe, you know how we see the movies of all the crowds in the streets? Well, we kept the kids in school, although it was hard. But we let them snake dance all around the school and out on the football field and things like that, and then we let them go home early. But there wasn't any great celebration because so many of them had family in the Pacific. And then on August 6th, now this will be of interest in this area, we knew when the atom bomb was dropped on August 6th on Hiroshima, we knew the end was near. I mean, we sensed that this was the end. However, we didn't realize the horror that it had caused. But as a result of that, it wasn't more than, 2 years. The next year in school it was. We noticed the philosophy of students had changed. We had lost control. We had lost control. Up until that time, we had no disciplinary problems. Their philosophy through their homes had got eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. And nobody's going to tell us what to do. It was, and we have seen, if you go back in the disciplinary problems, studying disciplinary problems in your school, up until that time, it would stand up to recite, you would miss so-and-so, you know. It was, I saw a drastic change in the attitude of the students. And I always have blamed it on the dropping of the atom bomb.
Were the families in Girard openly opposed to Truman dropping the bomb, or?
Well, I don't think that. I think that we were all convinced that it was the thing that had to be done at the time. But I think within a year's time, we saw the devastation and how fragile life was, and that you're here, might be here today and gone tomorrow. And then we went through these years of having these watchtowers and building these bomb shelters.
Tell me about that. That's something nobody else has touched on that I talked to.
About
the watchtowers and the bomb shelters.
Well, Rich and I were scheduled to go down to the stadium press box 6 o'clock to 9 o'clock every Tuesday night. And we would take a book or something and go down and sit there, and you'd have a radio on because it was to tell you, and there was a siren there. And if you would get anything on they had a certain station, you'd get anything on the radio, you were the siren, and everybody was to go to their bases or go to their bomb shelters.
What year was that? What year was that?
Yeah, and we watched the sky. 50. Well, we came in 50, but this was about 2 years after that.
Was
the early 50s, yeah.
Right.
It was after we were in Lisbon.
In Girard, during the war, did they have any kind of civilian air patrol, people who went out and watched for various sorts of planes?
No, we really didn't think much about that at that time till after the war was over.
Yeah.
And we were thinking more of them retaliating, and that was when Russia became, instead of an ally, became an enemy. That was really when we got into this watching the skies, wasn't it? It wasn't during the war.
There was no fear in Youngstown of the Japanese possibly making those steel mills, because you had all the steel mills of Pittsburgh, Sharon, Youngstown, all right down that corridor. Nobody was ever concerned that they would be bombed?
Oh, yes, during the war.
Yeah,
we were during the war, and in Girard, we had our shelters that we knew where we were to go. If we lived in a certain block, we knew that we reported to the basement of St. Rose School. That was the closest school. They always had it in a basement of a school or a church. And since we were within 2 blocks, so we could get there on foot in a hurry. And then we, our kids, when they were in first or second grade, Mary was in second grade because she had Mrs. Garrett. I know. But they would have practices. And every family was to have a plan. You were probably aware of school at this time.
Mm-hmm.
What time were you?
I'm 2 years older than that.
Oh, well,
maybe
yeah.
More than that.
But do you remember when you had drills? Drills for what you would do in time of disaster. You don't remember that?
Not for that kind of disaster. I can remember fire drills, but I don't remember any other kinds of.
Well, each family was to have a plan. If you get separated, of where you would meet or go for your children, and you would go someplace they had their own well. It was during the Cold War.
I can vaguely remember. civil defense
civil.
Becoming a big thing here in Lisbon,
yeah.
And they were talking about people building bomb shelters underground a year's
yeah.
supply
well,
of water.
Well, over here on North Market, this Cosma House on the corner of Prospect and Market has,
okay.
has one in their backyard yet to this day. Of course, it isn't used. The people by the name of Cosmas lived there, and they built one.
I was in school with the boy.
Yeah.
Okay.
That was the nearest one around here. And we, for months, Doc Leggett would give us these big distilled water jars, and every week I'd dump them and put fresh water in and keep them down the basement. Now, this was long after the
yeah,
war. This was the Cold War. This would be in the late 50s and early 60s.
What kind of a celebration do they have in Girard for VJ Day?
All right. Now, that is interesting because we knew by the first part of September when school started, we had a committee, and it was our teachers and the principal got together. How are we going to contain the children when this word gets out? If they are in school, we prayed it would be on a Saturday or a Sunday when they had been in the hands of the parents.
I can relate to that.
But if it happened to do it, well, we had a program ready. The band director would be notified, and they would get the band, call the band in, and they would go in the auditorium and say that we're having a special assembly. And I was the one that was in charge of calling. The minister that we had arranged to have was a dynamic speaker, and he was a preacher in Hubbard, Ohio, and his name was Paul Girard.
Yes, had
and,
to be.
And I had contacted him some time before and with our plan, and he consented that as soon as we heard, if I would call him, I had several alternate numbers to reach him, he would get in his car and come from Hubbard, which was about 15 minutes away, and to speak to the group. And so it happened during school hour. It was just right after lunch time. And so the band went to the auditorium. Reverend Girard got and were playing when Reverend Girard came in about 15 minutes later. And then they had a prayer time, and they got them all, you know, calmed down. And then they made the announcement that VJ Day had arrived, you know. And at that time, they turned on certain Youngstown radio station came on, and we had our PA system all hooked up. And they had reporters telling what was going on over the world. We tried to make it as interesting. That way we got over the initial shock so they didn't race out into the streets and start yelling. So that's what happened in school, and that was on September 12th. And then, I don't know, after that,
were you married at this time yet?
No, Rich, well, he'll tell you about that. Because he arrived home on Easter Sunday. That was April of 1946. And that's pretty much until we went on to school, but I'll let him.
We were married.
But that's pretty much how I spent the war.
Let me ask you one other thing. You alluded to before that you saw a difference in the behavior of the students. You said partly because of the dropping of the bomb. What other changes do you think it caused in society? The whole war, not just the dropping of the bomb, but what other changes?
Well,
you were at an ideal time in your life to pick up even subtle changes in society and culture and so on.
Well, people became more paranoid, fearful about nuclear energy in general. They didn't want any nuclear plants built near them. We still have the same feeling. Now, the Europeans, we have been in Europe, five times since the war. They depend almost 100% on nuclear power. They wouldn't have light, heat, anything if it wasn't. In the Scandinavian countries, France, Germany, all of them, you drive through, you see the powers of the power stations, and they're all nuclear. But here, I think, I don't know if it was because of a lack of education, a lack of need, and the fact that we had other sources, natural resources, to supply our power. But I think we all became a little paranoid, like building bomb shelters and things like that. I think that, as I say, we lost a lot of our faith in survival, you know, that God will take care of us, because we saw so many innocent people destroyed, and I think a lot of people lost their faith at that time. How do you think, Rich? Do you think of anything other way?
Did you see people get closer to the churches, though, during the war?
Oh, yes. That was evident.
Especially in a Catholic community like you were living, I would imagine that everybody went to Mass every day.
Oh, yes. It was very evident that religion was a part of their life. Their social life all of a sudden became revolved around the church.
I know what I wanted to ask you. I was thinking of talking before. Girard is basically, as you said, an ethnic community.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see a lot of the young men there who were first-generation Americans? They don't really have the patriotism yet, you know, in many ways that we do. Did you see a lot of them volunteering to go to service, too?
Well, that was beyond the years of volunteers, pretty much.
Okay,
see, that was when I was in college that I saw all this going on. But in Girard, when I got there, most of the men in the community were in the steel mills or in war industries.
And they got the permits for that, didn't they?
Yes. That was one thing that did keep a lot of people out.
Because I know my husband's brother volunteered, and his parents were very upset. They couldn't understand why he was volunteering, because to them, in many respects, this wasn't their country. Czechoslovakia was still their country.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Your parents both came from Czechoslovakia in the 20s. Okay, well, thank you.